Please stand by for the SORT Report, a collection of amateur radio news items from around the world.
And now this article from the ARRL audio letter, read by Rick Lynchquist and 1RL.
President George W. Bush has sent his greetings to all amateur radio operators, acknowledging their role in emergency communications and in generating international goodwill. Brennan Price, N4QX, has the details. The White House letter came as hams in the United States marked Amateur Radio Week, June 17th through 23rd, and got ready to participate in ARRL Field Day. "I salute amateur radio operators for your work on behalf of public safety officials," the president said. "I also commend your interest in communicating with persons in other parts of the world and learning about other cultures and countries. Your involvement builds understanding and goodwill around the globe." For the first time, Field Day this year was open to participation by amateurs throughout the Americas and the Caribbean. The president's letter acknowledged ham radio's important role in emergency communications, assisting law enforcement personnel and other emergency services as they carry out their responsibilities. ARRL President Jim Haney, W5JBP, expressed his delight at the presidential communication, saying he was extremely pleased that President Bush decided to recognize the accomplishments of amateur radio operators in the United States. President Bush said First Lady Laura Bush joined him in sending their best wishes. I'm Brennan Price, N4QX.
In addition to the White House letter, governors in several states issued proclamations designating Amateur Radio Week or Amateur Radio Month during June. A Florida CB-er accused of jamming amateur radio operations and transmitting without a license was convicted in federal court June 19th on 8 misdemeanor counts. William Flippo of Jupiter was found guilty of 4 counts of operating without a license and 4 counts of deliberate and malicious interference. The jury deliberated about 30 minutes. Federal District Court Judge Daniel T.K. Hurley noted that while the charges were misdemeanors, it was important that the amateur airwaves be free of interference in the event of an emergency. He ordered that Flippo, 60, remain in custody and undergo a psychiatric evaluation prior to sentencing. The prosecutor in the case, Neil Karabdil, credited members of the amateur radio community with bringing Flippo to justice. The list included ARRL 1999 International Humanitarian Award winner Ed Petzold, K1LNC, who helped the FCC gather evidence in the case.
This is a very good day for amateur radio and a very good day for justice. Let the word go out. We will not tolerate this sort of thing on our frequencies, and you will be caught.
Petzold said Flippo primarily had targeted the Jupiter to Cuesta repeater group for jamming and regularly interfered with amateur operations, especially on 10 and 2 meters over a period of about 3 years. Following up on the amateur's complaints, personnel from the FCC's Tampa District Office visited the Jupiter area at least twice in 1999 and reported tracking the offending signals to Flippo's residence. Known as Rabbit Ears within the CB community, Flippo was arrested by federal authorities in July 2000. He already faces a $20,000 fine levied in 1999 for unlicensed operation and willful and malicious interference to ham radio communications and failure to let the FCC inspect his radio equipment. The 6.5-day trial was anything but routine a day after attempting to fire his court-appointed attorney, Robert Adler, who countered that Flippo was trying to undermine his own trial. Flippo, then still free on a $100,000 bond, drove himself to the hospital June 13th, claiming he'd suffered a stroke. He was released the following day. Hurley recessed the trial but took the unusual step of revoking Flippo's bond June 17th after a physician told the judge that medical tests determined that Flippo had not had a stroke. Sentencing could take place in about a month. Flippo faces a maximum penalty of 8 years in prison, 1 year on each count, and he could be fined up to $80,000. If all goes as planned, a group of amateur radio operators and amateur rocket enthusiasts is poised to make aerospace history this summer by putting the first amateur rocket into space. Jennifer Hagee, N1TDY, has that story.
The Civilian Space Exploration Team, CSXT, is hoping the suborbital vehicle will carry its amateur radio payloads to an altitude of more than 60 nautical miles. One of the hams involved, Eric Knight, KB1EHE of Unionville, Connecticut, says amateur radio is central to the whole flight. The rocket's APRS, ATV, and packet telemetry gear will enable the team to document its success, he says. space is defined as 50 nautical miles. The team is aiming to attain an altitude of 62 nautical miles with its rocket. Other amateurs involved include Rod Lane and one FNE, whose garage and basement workshop have been largely given over to rocket construction and integration, and Don Skinner and one HWR. Assisting in the project for the past 3 years has been high school senior Julia Cohn, KB1IGU. Cohn has been involved in constructing and programming some of the sequencing electronics that will go aboard the vehicle. Her electronics instructor and mentor is Chet Bacon, KA1ILH. Other students in Bacon's electronics classes also have contributed to the project. In all, Knight says 16 key people, including spouses, have immersed themselves in the rocket project. Among them is a real rocket scientist, Jerry Larson, an almost ham, and an engineer with Lockheed Martin in Colorado. The team has built the vehicle itself right down to the solid rocket propellant grain. Overseeing the effort is Kai Michelson of Minnesota, a semi-retired stuntman and veteran rocket hobbyist who holds dozens of rocket speed records and is the project's primary financial backer. Michelson serves as president of the National Experimental Rocketry Association. To say that the project has become nearly all-consuming would be an understatement. We're passionate about it, Knight says, estimating that the team members easily have spent hundreds of hours apiece over the course of the 5-year mission. At this point, they've been working almost around the clock, he said. Funding for the project has come from the team members' pockets. Knight calculates the costs to date are approaching $100,000. And as he put it, a lot of our vacation money goes into this. We've convinced our wives that the desert is a good place to spend a couple of weeks. There's no prize or reward whatsoever, Knight said, only the historic recognition of being the first amateurs to build and launch a rocket into space. This is Jennifer Hagee, N1TDY.
And now this article from the Amateur Radio Newsline.
More on the Flippo case in future Amateur Radio Newsline reports. Politics appears to be starting to play a part in internet-based radio linking. According to Lee Williams, N3APP, a ham considered as being the father of iLink, named Graham Barnes, M0SCH, has locked out all users running the EchoLink software from his servers. Also, iLink users have had to download new software to stay online. To counter the eviction, EchoLink proponent Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD, has set up new servers to allow users of that software to have connectivity, at least for those who want it. Williams says that Barnes and Taylor's are cooperating on the connectivity issue, but caught in the middle are thousands of hams who do not care which program is in their computer. All they want to do is talk to one another, and they really do not care whose server system their signal is routed through. Hams in Australia are about to face some of the toughest electromagnetic exposure regulations found anywhere in the world. The idea is to protect people from RF. Q News' Graham Kemp, VK4BB, has the details.
In Australia, all radio amateurs will be required to know about new electromagnetic radiation controls, which are expected to be included in amateur station license conditions from the 1st of July. Compliance level 1 applies to transmitters that are covered by either of these conditions. A, the total average power fed to all antennas at the site must not exceed 100 watts and antennas must be out of reach. And B, the bottom of the lowest antenna must be at least 10 meters above ground and the average EIRP does not exceed 3,200 watts. Compliance level 2 requires measurements and documented proof of compliance, and this applies to all other transmitters. It is proposed that the new regulatory framework will be reflected in the license condition determination, the LCDs for the amateur service, and all apparatus licenses on the 1st of July. That means amateur stations operated under new amateur licenses issued on or after that date must comply with the framework. Reporting for Newsline from Australia's Q News, I'm Graham Kemp, VK4BB.
And what about current Australian licensees? They have until October 1st to bring their stations into compliance with the new RF exposure rules. July 15th is the deadline set by Representative Billy Tuzin for the Hollywood studios, the computer industry, and consumer electronics manufacturers to develop a method to protect digital TV from being pirated onto the Internet. The chairman of the influential House Commerce Committee is growing impatient over the stalled transition to digital TV. He also knows that the switch won't happen until movies and popular TV series can be protected from exposure to cyberspace piracy. If private negotiations fail, Tuzin says that he is prepared to step in and mandate government intervention. And finally this week, while the entertainment industry is concerned about digital piracy of its products, the public is wondering where digital television is today and where it is really going. One of those asking is a listener to the DX audio service named Victor Schmidt. He wrote to editor and host Fred Vonby, W8HDU, for some answers. Here is part one of W8HDU's reply as it originally aired on the May 2002 edition of the DX Audio Service magazine.
Well, Victor, there's been a lot of misinformation on digital television. First of all, let's address the issue of analog stations going away. I don't think that we'll see analog go away for a long, long time. Congress was very optimistic about digital television and how the public would embrace it. Congress has many grandiose ideas, but they forget that business and the public are the ones that fund the change and do not have the checkbooks that Congress has with a money tree attached to keep the balance in the black. First of all, understand that a television station will not want to turn off their analog channel unless their viewing public has transitioned over to digital. Further, the law says that they can stay on analog at least until 85% of the public in the viewing area has stopped using analog sets, and they are now watching on digital sets. So the short answer here is, in gazing into my crystal ball, I see analog around until 2015.
Fred will be back next week with a look at the kinds of television receivers now in the stores, those that go into your personal computer, and what the future has in store. Be sure to tune in.
I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, with an interesting story provided to us by Bob Gonset, W6VR, and the CGC Communicator. The June 10th partial solar eclipse attracted quite a bit of attention because the event could be easily seen. However, the sun is also a powerful source of microwave signals, so the eclipse should have been visible in the microwave's radio spectrum as well. And thanks to the efforts of Dr. Brian Daugherty of Caltech, we now have graphs of the solar microwave area of the eclipse. Dr. Daugherty operates a microwave dish at California Owens Valley. That antenna is tied to receivers that record the radio spectrum of the sun every 9.6 seconds, covering approximately 100 frequencies from 1 to 18 gigahertz. With a bit of data processing, we are now all able to see the eclipse in the microwave region with our own eyes. You do that by going to the URL that appears in the print edition of this week's Amateur Radio Newsline report.
And now this article from Q News, VK4WIA in Queensland, Australia.
Light beam teleportation claimed. Scientists at Australian National University have succeeded in teleportation, the disembodiment of a thing in one location and its reconstruction in another. In this case, a beam of light allegedly disappeared in one place, reappeared in another, a short distance away, via the mechanism of quantum entanglement. Data embedded in the beam was also recovered. Now, if verified, this experiment would certainly be regarded as one of the most remarkable findings of the century. And of last.
WRC 2003, Geneva bound. For this story, we'll be crossing to Jeremy Boot, the RSGB newsreader. We reported on Q News last week that Venezuela had withdrawn its invitation for the World Radio Conference in 2003, and that therefore the location of the conference was uncertain.
But the ARRL has told us that WRC-03 has now been rescheduled for Geneva. The conference was due to be held in Caracas. but the Venezuelan National Commission of Telecommunications rescinded the invitation, saying that they've got economic concerns. The ARRL says that the ITU is expected to issue a formal announcement regarding the new venue in the near future. There are several issues of importance to radio amateurs on the conference agenda, including the revision of Article 25 of the International Radio Regulations. This includes the issue of whether to retain the treaty requirement to demonstrate Morse code proficiency for access to amateur bands below 30 MHz. Also on the agenda is the question of harmonization of the 7 MHz amateur and broadcasting allocations. WRCO3 will now take place in Geneva from the 9th of June to the 4th of July 2003.
WIA Intruder Watch.
Tom Walker, VK4BTW. We thank you for Intruder Watch notes number 115 from QDC magazine, and I'll quote briefly, and this is dealing with an article by VK2AUQ in Digipede of March, giving a description of mode MT63, which is a DSP-based advanced HF mode for amateur radio, intended to provide high-performance keyboard-to-keyboard conversational operation on HF bands under poor conditions. There is, of course, a catch to this, in that the mode appears to generate wider signals for a given data rate than other modes, and can cause interference to other signals, whilst not itself being so affected by other modes. So it must be used with discretion, depending on band occupancy and conditions. The sound is described as a roaring noise, and many have reported this to Tom and also to Henry Addison, VK8HA, our federal coordinator, as an intruder. So the Intruder Watch could use the services of any amateurs who are using these wideband data modes and could separate amateur from the non-amateur.
This has been a production of the Southern Ontario Repeater Team. News items were gathered from other broadcasts all over the world. Until next week, 73s, and thank you for listening.